Sometimes I dream of shucking the yoke of the capitalist machine, getting in a van and just driving away, going where I want, when I want, no address, no commitments. But you know what holds me back?
What, me?
No, it's coffee. I just can't give up Spark Plug coffee. You see, Spark Plug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always directly sourced and fair trade. They offer a variety of blends and roasts to suit anyone, even a rotating feature blend for my adventurous spirit. But the best part is that Spark Plug delivers this exceptional coffee to you in Canada or the US within just 1 week of custom roasting it so that it reaches you guaranteed fresh and you will taste the difference. You can order Spark Plug as you need it or join the Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is totally flexible and customizable, convenience without the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I think I am holding you back.
I've been saying it.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy day, everybody, and thanks for joining us and saying sayonara to the merry month of May. This is the 394th edition of the Ellis's Analysis, the 8-year-old podcast that reviews classic movies. We used to review the classic movies on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 groupings of Cool Flicks. But we finished that in December 2015. Now we talk about whatever, and we spoil all the whatevers. I'm the homebody who wouldn't normally want anything to do with a houseless, nomadic lifestyle, but after being cooped up for over a year, a little bit more, Ryan Ellis. And here's the very independent lady who walks down the middle of the street, even when those streets have perfectly good sidewalks, Frances McDormand, and also my wife, Bev.
That's me.
If you're going to be Frances McDormand, you might as well be a little terse in your awards acceptance. I watched the Oscars speeches again for the three wins we'll talk about in a second. Frances McDormand seems like she's almost mad she's winning, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. She is the coming attractions trivia, Fran McDormand is. She's been directed by several women, and both men and women of color, fairly often during her career, which means she isn't a hypocrite about her infamous inclusion writer statement at the Oscars a few years ago. But not including Nomadland, who we know was directed by an Asian woman. What was the most recent live-action movie she was in that was directed by a woman or anyone of color?
I had to go all the way back to 2008 to find it, and it was Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, directed by Bharat Naruli, who's an Indian man.
Is it Naluri? Or did I write that down wrong? Maybe you wrote it down wrong.
Well, shoot. I'm going to assume that you got it right, because you are more meticulous than I. And that was, like I said, back in 2008, so I was a little surprised it took that long to get there because you said how often she works with non-white male directors. Prior to that film, there was a run of 4 films in a row that were all directed by women. Friends with Money, Aeon Flux, North Country, Something's Gotta Give, and if you go a little further back, Laurel Canyon, Madeline, she walks the walk.
The funny thing is, I thought about this question assuming I'd find a lot of this. And there is, in that stretch, like you said, for about 10 years, but especially in that 4 or 5 year clump. But when you go back to the beginning of her career, and of course she worked so much with Joel and Ethan Coen, her husband and brother-in-law, not then, but he became that since, Joel did. And for a while there, not just those guys, but it was white men, which isn't her choice. That's the way it was in Hollywood.
It was before she won an Oscar and became the type of person who could get a film greenlit. So she wasn't famous back then. She was basically a working actor. She couldn't pick and choose her projects.
I wasn't blaming her.
After Fargo.
I wasn't blaming her. My point was just that, did she actually work with that many people who are different from her? And for this century so far, generally that's been true. But for a little clump there, it was extraordinarily true. Yeah, and Bharat was born in India. And Chloe Zhao did say in her Oscar acceptance speech she was born in China, although she now lives, I believe, in America, and has, I think, for a long time, much like Lee Isaac Chung from Minari, the director and writer of that.
Well, he really was raised in America. He was born in Korea, but...
And I'll say again what I've said before, that this movie might very well be the product of her inclusion writer statement at the Oscars when she won for 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, because I have a feeling, I don't know, I've never heard this story, but it just seems logical that she maybe had this screenplay on her desk and didn't quite have the stroke that maybe Meryl Streep would have if she wanted to play the character to say, I want this to be made, I want to star in it, and I want Chloe Zhao to direct it. We're making it. But after she won that Oscar, maybe that's what happened. Maybe not, but it seems logical to me.
Well, the story is definitely that she approached Chloe Zhao. Yeah, she did have some power behind it, A, getting made, and B, hiring Chloe Zhao, after she saw The Rider, Chloe Zhao's movie before this.
Mm-hmm. All right, Nomadland was released on Disney Plus here in Canada on April 9th, 2021. We saw it that day, and now we see it again about a month and a half later. Box office numbers aren't worth a hill of beans in this crazy world of 2020 and a lot of 2021 so far. America's opening up with their theaters, but we're not here in Canada yet, so those numbers are pretty non-existent up here. But the film has grossed a little over $2 million on the big screen so far this year, and it's like I said, I think in the Oscars show we did a few weeks ago, when they reopen theaters fully, these big 24-screen multiplexes, have your Marvel movies, have your, I don't know what's even playing this summer, have the big blockbusters, but then make room for four or five screens for this, and Minari, and The Father, and all these movies that no one really saw on the big screen.
Tenet, even.
Sure, give Tenet its proper big screen run, even though I didn't care about that movie, and neither did you.
No, I shouldn't have even brought it up.
Last week I was ranting about Christopher Nolan, but I won't do that today, because this movie is nothing like any of his films. But please, Beth, the movie's only weeks old from our standpoint. Explain it to everyone anyway with the Nomadland skinny.
Frances McDormand is Fern, a 60-something widow living in her van. She is part of a community of nomads who travel around the United States taking seasonal work where they can get it and enjoying their freedom and autonomy. Life on the road is sweet, but it's hard, and when opportunities to settle down present themselves, Fern must decide if this is really the life for her.
Very simple story. A lot of Best Picture winners in recent history, or at least some of the other ones, like Green Book, doesn't have that much in common with this other than it's a road movie. This is very much a road movie. They shot in Arizona, Nevada, Nebraska, South Dakota, and California. And I wonder about that because it's never anywhere near L.A. by the looks of it, but she's on the coast a few times. You see the water from the ocean cresting on the rocks of a shoreline, but that's probably Northern California because Empire, Nevada, where this starts and where her life was before she went on the road, is Northwest Nevada. And also it's probably high elevation. That's why she's sleeping in snow sometimes and obviously is barely getting by with the cold. One thing I wouldn't like, but I'll do the nutshell that applies to other things I don't like. The cold would not be fun, sleeping in a van that's probably barely warm enough to get by. She's tough, tougher than me. But Nomadland, in a nutshell, lack of showers and lack of TV make Ryan something something.
I do wonder a lot in this movie, what does she smell like? What do they all smell like?
Dreadful, probably.
There's times when she has access to showers when they're at campgrounds, but there's just got to be weeks on end where she's just got to make do with what? Gas station bathrooms?
I get the feeling she had long hair because when she meets up with that old friend, I don't know if they're really friends, but that person she knew and the daughters, the one daughter especially, they talk about how she cut her hair. So maybe she had really long hair. And smartly, she has it quite short. If I was going to do something like this, I'd probably just shave my head. Okay, the numbers on this movie, I guess we know this, are pretty strong. The critics liked it a lot. Rotten Tomatoes, 94% of critics are fans of this, and that's on the strength of 400 reviews. So that's a pretty good sample size, and 83% of audiences, which is considerably lower. The IMDb also doesn't love this movie that much. It's not even an 8 on there. Not that it's a 6.2 or anything. It's a 7.8 or 9 or 4, whatever it was. So far, it's 18th at the box office in 2021. Godzilla vs. Kong, number 1. Judas and the Black Messiah is number 12. And Minari is 17th. And I bet by the time we post this podcast, a couple of those could still change because it's this year. It won the 3 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress. We talked about the Oscars in our pre- and post-show, especially the post-show, of course, about that weirdness of having Best Picture about halfway into the show and then ending with Best Actor. That was odd to not end with Best Picture. It was also nominated for the screenplay by Chloe Zhao, the editing by Chloe Zhao, and the cinematography by James Joshua Richards. Didn't win those three, but could have won maybe all three, and certainly the cinematography, which I know you were rooting for, but it didn't win that one.
I'm not mad that Mank won. That was a beautiful film. And as some people pointed out, when you let the sun be your lighting department, when Magic Hour is painting that picture for you, it's a bit of a lower bar to get over. So I was like, all right, fine. But I still say that Zhao should have won editing because so much of this film is told in the editing. I also learned this week that Chloe Zhao and Joshua James Richards are a couple.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they went on the road together. They made this film together. They're just an adorable couple. He is a babe. I looked up pictures and, well, actually I watched this little making of thing that he was in and he is a stone fox. So go, Chloe.
I may have said his name wrong a few minutes ago. It's Joshua James, not James Joshua. He's only shot 4 films so far and 3 of them are for his now girlfriend. I didn't know that till right now, but Songs My Brothers Taught Me and The Rider. He shot those in addition to this one. A little bit more about the Oscars, though. Frances McDormand is the first woman to get nominations for acting and producing the same film. Men have done that, not that often even for them. And Chloe Zhao is the first woman with those four specific nominations of picture, director, the screenplay, and the editing. And very few other people have done it at all. And one more thing about the Oscars, I didn't know this until I rewatched the show. Her howl, Franz Howell, when they won Best Picture, that was a tribute to Michael Wolf Snyder, so that's why it's a wolf howl. He was a sound man on this movie, and he committed suicide, I think, before it came out. Suicide comes up later on, of course, because Bob, one of the real people, of course, this movie is filled with real people. Almost everybody in the movie is just a regular person, never acted before, probably will never act again. They're also really good, though.
Yeah.
And he talks about how his son killed himself, and one of his ways to cope was to help others. And so you got two suicides here. And while we're talking about right now, I was going to say for towards the end of the podcast, but I'll bring it up now because we are on the suicide kick. It's been about a month, but my cousin Jason committed suicide. It's not been easy to deal with that, especially late at night by myself. I'm more of a deal with it by myself person. And I'm not one of those people that likes to lecture people about, get help, there's something out there for you. Bell, you work for Bell, of course. They always have their day, I think it's in February, the Get Help Day, whatever
Bell
you call
Let's
it.
Talk
That's
day.
It, Let's Talk Day.
Their whole initiative is about mental health.
And they bring it up a lot through the years, I recall, but especially on that one day. So if you're in a bad place like he obviously was, then talk to somebody. He and I hadn't talked in a while. I'm going to feel bad about that forever. We didn't really have a falling out exactly. We just lost touch. But he was my best friend overall my whole life. You are now. But I'm 47, and for probably about 37 of those years, he was my best friend. If you're Bob's son, if you're Wolf, the sound guy, if you're Jason Ellis, please, don't suffer in silence. Okay, so back to the movie. We know it's real people and a real story, effectively. Yes, Frances McDormand's an actress, and so is David Strathairn and his son, Tay Strathairn. But almost everyone else in this movie goes by their actual name, and they're real people who actually are nomads. There's not much performing in this movie. They actually didn't realize that McDormand was an actress until she told them who she was. And it's not like she's ever looked like a movie star anyway. It's one reason she can be a character actress, despite three Oscars for acting and one for producing, which means she's one of the most rewarded people ever, especially living. Her husband, Beau, worked at the U.S. Gypsum Mine in Empire, Nevada. That's northwest, like I said, of the state. And it was shut down in 2011. And they discontinued the zip code. That's the opening card, and I looked it up, and that's all true. But it also says online that it was a ghost town for about 5 years, but there are people living there now. Less than 100, but there are people living, and I don't know if they're reopening the mine, probably not, but they're doing something there now. So that town is not continuing to be closed down, but it was for a while.
Wild story, though, that they closed that mine, and it only took 6 months to discontinue the zip code. That is crazy that you can dismantle something that quickly. And it was unique in the sense that it was a pretty isolated town, so their community was very strong. They really had this family of a community out there in the middle of nowhere, and then it was destroyed overnight.
Doesn't Fern talk in some of her conversations with the people on the road that Beau loved his job, too?
Yes.
This wasn't just he did this for a living, but he loved doing it. And I think he was in the office. It wasn't like he was down in the mines. I think he was an office guy. But
well,
maybe he did both.
She did HR, she said. I can't remember what she said he did. But everybody loved him, and he loved everybody. And he was really happy there. So I have a question for you. Do you think she would have been a wanderer were it not for Beau, and he held her back? While she obviously grieves him. She's obviously broken without him. She misses him so much. There's no doubt about that. But when she starts getting attention from Dave, she is immediately repelled by him. Anybody that could tie her down again. And I was curious, watching the movie this second time around, if when Beau died, it freed her a little bit. She never could have had this life with him, but she loves this life.
That's a good analysis. What did she really want all along? Did she want to be a wanderer to begin with? Jack Nicholson's character in Five Easy Pieces is never going to be settled. You get that feeling that he wasn't when he was younger. He could have been a piano prodigy. His whole family are musicians. He goes back to see them, and that doesn't go very well. He can still play the piano, though, even though he doesn't really ever do it anymore. And he's doing these jobs that are, let's call it what it is, beneath him. And the movie ends with him chucking it all. It's one of those famous endings. I don't want to give anything away, but the movie is over 40 years old. 50 years old, actually. It's 51 years old. He's probably going to be a wanderer regardless. Although you could argue if that character, Bobby, were to find the right person for him and settle down, that could be fine. But then if another 20 years goes by and he gets to be what Fern's age is, which is probably around retirement age, would he go back to being unsettled and wander? Yeah. So I think these characters are tied in together. So my answer for you is she wouldn't have meant this negatively, but she'll settle for Bo and settle for this life in this small town. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She chose him. And I don't think she regrets her choice. She loved that man so much. Her grief is almost another character that is carried with her everywhere she goes and everything she does. So I don't have any doubts that she considered it worthwhile. But her life that she's living now without him is so vastly different than her life was with him. And of course, we learn throughout the film that she has plenty of opportunities to settle down. She could never recreate her life with Bo, but she could recreate a community and a place that she could belong in. And she repeatedly chooses not to.
The scenes towards the end with Davis Dretheron's family. So like I said, Tay plays his actual son, James. Tay's only been in three films. The others were Eight Men Out with his dad. I don't know if he has any scenes with his dad, but he's in that with him. And also Lone Star, also a John Sayles film, as Eight Men Out is. But I don't think Strathairn's in that movie, surprisingly, because he was in so many of the John Sayles films. Peter Spears, one of the producers on this, who won an Oscar, plays Peter. He's one of the family members. Those brief scenes in their house are so great. And one of the reasons why is we see little moments like the father and son playing piano. And
love
she watches that.
Yeah.
When, I guess it would be Dave's daughter-in-law. I'm not even sure if they're married. The woman says, Dave likes you, which we know, but this woman's confirming that for her. But then that same night, I think it's supposed to be, maybe it's supposed to be weeks later, but in the chronology of the movie, it's the same night. It's seconds later in the film. She can't sleep in the house. She has to go to her camper to sleep. So maybe that's part of the element now, too, is that she's been living in this van for getting close to a year, and she can't even sleep in a house, even though this seems like it would be an awesome life to have with these wonderful people, this guy that she definitely likes. Maybe she's not romantically attached to him. And getting back to what you said, maybe she doesn't want to be romantically attached to him because, yeah, I could finish my life with this man, but I can't.
Yeah, she obviously cares about Dave. She cares for him when he's sick, visits him in the hospital. She follows him to Waldrug. And I believe that when she visits him and his family, it's so that she can decide for herself if she could settle down with him. And of course, she gets her answer because she's just so uncomfortable. She's trying to crawl out of her skin every time she lives in this civilized manner, whether it's her sister's house or it's Dave's family's house. And I can't tell how to feel about Dave's attention to her because it's really evident from the beginning of the film that he makes her so uncomfortable. Every time he does anything flirtatious and tries to get closer to her, she is running in the other direction and he keeps pursuing her. Maybe that's part of what turns her off, that he just refuses to read her signals. Or I think she just truly doesn't want to ever be tied down. It's not really about Dave. There's nothing wrong with Dave. They obviously have a connection.
We don't get into her head, which is interesting for an Oscar-winning character. Of course, there's no voiceover, smartly. And the scenes with him are important that we don't learn more, actually. It'd be nice to learn more, but I'm glad we don't. Strathairn and McDormand are a retirement age at this point, give or take, as the characters are supposed to be. So she can look at him. Maybe I'm misreading this. Maybe you're right. Maybe she doesn't want him around. But then she does seek him out at the hospital. She doesn't have to go to the hospital and give him stuff. So I think she does like him.
She doesn't have to go to the house and visit him, but
right.
She does.
One of the most important gestures McDormand's ever had in her whole career. I thought it was more of a deliberate thing than it is, where she touches the chair where he sat for their Thanksgiving dinner. No one else is up. She maybe is still thinking, do I want to stay? Maybe I will. I haven't really decided yet. But she gets up and just touches the chair, and it's almost like he's sitting there. And it's a really great touch. Because that's probably the last time she'll ever see him. But then she knows where he is now. He's probably going to stay settled. He seems like he finally wants to be because of the grandson and all the rest. That was also a good touch, too, when he puts the grandson in her lap and she reacts worse than, you're not bad with babies, despite your lack of kid thing. Me, too. I think we're
just
okay with babies.
Her behavior is just what's going on in my head when anybody puts a baby in my lap. I can fake it.
But she can't fake it. So this is the last time she sees him in the chronology of the movie. And unless she seeks him out, that might be the last time she ever sees him.
And the following scene after she leaves, where does she go? She goes to the coast, and it's this windy, blustery, rainy day. It looks cold, and she's at the cliffs, and the sea is violent. Those waves are crashing. There's mist everywhere, and she is alive again. She goes from being uncomfortable in her own skin to being where she belongs, and it's really obvious. And in that scene, the jacket that she's wearing is Bo's jacket that she got from the storage locker at the beginning of the film. I really noticed it this time because it was a second viewing. So it's a combination of she leaves and she's relieved to be free, to go wherever she wants, to be on her own, to commune with nature, which is clearly very important to her, but also back with Bo in a way. Maybe she'll just never get over him. She talks to Bob about it in that beautiful scene at the end where Bob talks about his son dying. She talks about how she's trying to cope with her grief. What does he say? I'll see you down the road.
See you down the road.
Oh, what a beautiful,
doesn't want to say goodbye.
Beautiful notion.
No goodbyes. I'll see you down the road.
And it says so much, that line, about grief at that stage of life, too, because these are all baby boomers. They're pretty much most of them in their 60s.
And when we see them doing work, Fran, Linda May, mostly those two, I guess, it isn't easy. And how long can they keep doing this stuff?
Dude, they work really hard. Mm. You're tough as nails now, but it's just a matter of time before your body lets you down. It happens to literally everybody. So this is probably temporary. You see all these people in their 60s, but you don't see very many people in their 80s in those vans, shitting in buckets. You talk about having bad knees, but when you have a bad heart or you need real medical intervention or...
In America, where that's not paid for, like it is here.
Well, look what happens to Swanky. That's a great story, too. She's sick. She's like, I'm not going to spend the end of my life indoors.
There's cancer. Let's not forget that. That's the worst thing.
And it's terminal, too. She knows it's terminal. So forget it. I'm not going to hospital. I'm going to die on my own terms. She had Jack Kevorkian's book. She had it all planned out.
And she does. And, of course, they throw rocks in the fire like she wanted at the end. And they all say something nice. Although, I don't think that Fern does she?
She just throws the rock in the fire.
Bob says, I'll see you down the road, I believe. It's before, because he's sitting beside Fern, and then she gets up and I think says nothing. The scene with Swanky the first time, and this almost never happens to me, the first time I saw this movie, almost broke me up. It was less this time. Usually it's the other way around. It's more like, oh, I know it's coming. But where she talks about being on a canoe or something, or one of those paddle boats. Kayak, that's what it was. And we see a reprise of this later on. Well, it's a video she sends her. That's what it is, isn't it? Swanky sends a video to Fern.
With the eggshells.
Right. But she talks about how it was a perfect moment, and she saw in the reflection of the water, the birds, almost like they're underneath, reminding me of the scene in Immortal Beloved, where the young Beethoven runs away from his father beating on him. What a great scene, too. I watched that movie again not long ago in Prime or something. I hadn't seen it in a long time. But the young Beethoven ends up in water, and the stars are reflected in the water, so it's almost like he's part of the universe. He's just floating up there. And the way Swanky described that sounded a lot like that. But also when she said, I could die now and be happy, that's one of my peak moments. I don't think I've had anything like that before, but wow, I do respect that attitude.
And maybe that's something that we'll understand more once we're older.
Especially if we're sick, and especially with cancer. Mm. But yeah, that was still a powerful moment. Certainly the Bob conversation was more so this time because my cousin was alive when we saw the movie the first time, talking about his son's suicide. But what's interesting about this movie, too, the very first dialogue in the whole film is about money, where Fern says to the guy who runs the storage center thing, here's what I owe you. So it's about money, and this is a movie that's not about money. They make what they have to get by. They work these jobs at Amazon. She's back there. This is basically a year in the life of. She works seasonally, so that's the Christmas rush. Linda May is working with her at that point. Linda May works with her when they're cleaning bathrooms and picking up garbage and stuff. They seem happy.
But you say it's a movie that's not about money, and they don't talk about money all that much, but money is everywhere in this film. It's where she can't afford to fix her van. It's where they go to the RV sales thing and they look at the RVs they could never afford. It's where she's visiting her sister and these people are talking about real estate and how they could have done this thing and gotten even richer. That line, I wish I had all that money in 2008 so that I could have bought the houses when they were cheap as dirt and then I'd be rich now. And she gets mad at them.
An empire would not exist anymore if it weren't for money.
Yeah, if the mine was still viable. Linda May says, I've been working since I was 12, and my Social Security was only $500 a month, not even remotely enough to live on. Money is, a lot of them even say, it's the motivation for them to live this life. They've chosen it, and they have found happiness. But in a big way, a lot of these people were forced to live in their cars. A lot of them would have maybe chosen something really dramatically different if economics hadn't forced them into this decision. I tried to look up when the movie takes place, and I couldn't find anything specific. The mine closed in 2011, and they're never really clear about how long Fern has been on the road. But it seems like it's obviously not long enough to know about their little private Burning Man thing that they have.
It's a short period of time she's been on the road.
Right, right.
But Bo's illness could have been years. His cancer could have been a long time, for all we know, or even a year.
Yeah, that's true.
And maybe they just lived there on whatever savings they had and did other kinds of jobs for a while after the mine closed down. Although it sounds like When the gypsum mine closed, the town closed pretty fast too. But it might have been a couple of years, give or take.
But a lot of other people talked about 2008. When that financial crash happened, a lot of people lost their life savings. The bottom just came out for a lot of people that even were doing all right. Not even people living on the margins. And when you're that age, you can't redo a life's work and a life savings. So you're just kind of forced to cope with what you have.
Especially in a country like America that doesn't have a proper health care plan for the majority of their citizens. Even with Obamacare, not enough people have coverage. And God knows if that'll even last.
Or a safety net for people who can't afford to live in a house for $500 a month. There's nowhere in America you could afford to
live. But specifically for health care, when you get to be that age, that's when things start breaking down on you, and you probably need something, even if it's just some kind of prescription pills. And if that's not covered by a plan, or not covered by a national plan, insurance that you might have had through your job, whatever, or through a retirement, which I believe we'll have when we retire, I'm not sure about that, maybe we won't, then that's a little bit sick. So these people are getting by barely. When I said it wasn't about money, I meant in the Wolf of Wall Street sense, where everything in that movie is about money, 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 money. Or a heist film, where, of course, it's all about money, too. You're right, though. It's an underlying element. So maybe that dialogue is appropriate. Here's what I owe you, because the movie's all about who owes who.
You open the movie with a storage locker. It's her past. And she sees Beau's clothes. She sees her dad's dishes.
Which get broken by Dave, accidentally.
Yeah.
At the end, she's going back to talk to that guy. And she's given up everything that's left in there, other than maybe she takes something. We don't really see if she puts more things in the van. I'm assuming she does. But most of that stuff, here you go. Mm-hmm. And that's the last time she'll probably ever see that guy. Again, unless she seeks him out, because she'll have no reason to go back to Empire and that storage center, because she no longer has a locker there.
They hug the first time at the beginning of the film. But when she's saying goodbye to him for good, they don't hug.
Hmm.
She still has an attachment to the town, to her stuff. And when they hug, he seems awkward, and she's the one who's really giving him the hug. But by the end, she's ready to say goodbye, and she's ready to commit to life on the road.
There were issues taken with this movie about the Amazon stuff, the seasonal work. I don't really know why, because as much as we could hack on Amazon for the next 5 minutes, and I don't really want to do that, everyone's done that on Twitter for the last few years, and they have great points. I'm not arguing with any of that. But if you have a giant conglomerate like that, you obviously have people. They're going to work at Christmas time. More than any other time because of the rush. There may be other times of the year where there's a huge rush. This past year, I'm sure Amazon, we know they did better than ever because people had to order from them rather than go to a store and buy stuff. And that'll probably continue. They were already huge before the pandemic, let alone now. So it ends up being a movie of the moment for that reason. And Amazon and those kinds of companies don't deserve credit for giving people like this work. But this is the one way that people are probably going to be able to find jobs temporarily. I don't know that this character or Linda May or Swanky or Bob would want to work at a company, whatever that company is, all the time. They seem like they want the freedom to work for a month or maybe a couple of months and then see ya, I'm going to some other state.
And apparently that's real. The Amazon thing that they employ seasonal workers, of course they do, but that they have a campground that they set aside for the transitional people that come in that live in their campers or their cars just to work at Amazon. And it's a really common thing for the nomads because, of course, we haven't really talked about this. These are all real people, with the exception of, obviously, actors like Frances McDormand, the actor who plays Dave, her sister, and stuff like that. But most of the nomads that are in the film are real nomads. And all the seasonal jobs that they do are real seasonal jobs that these real community people do, like a circuit around America following the seasonal work, doing it years that they want to and skipping it years that they don't have to or don't want to. But they go to Amazon, they do the beet farming, they go to places like Wall Drug. And the shoot actually went to these locations. They went to those beet farms and they spent time in Amazon. I honestly wondered, both times I saw this movie, did Amazon help pay for this film? If that was the case, it would be on Prime instead of Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Because they get a hero shot at the outside of that building with the Amazon logo. And every time anybody asks her what it's like to work on Amazon, she has nothing but nice things to say. It actually looks like a very pleasant place to work. She just says, oh, the money's good. They give you a place to camp. It's great. There's no criticism. Although there's no criticism for any of her employers. She doesn't seem to have a bad word to say about anybody who gives her a job.
When you work for a brief period of time, that may be true. I'm sure a lot of people that heard of this movie that will never watch it would have criticisms, meaning rich people. But if they did watch it, they'd probably say, see, job creators. And obviously giant companies are job creators more than we could ever be. You and I
could
ever be.
It's not a charity giving somebody a job. They create jobs because they need people to do the labor. They're not doing them a favor.
No, I'm not saying that. Exactly. Yeah. That's true. And then people who don't have a lot are going to put that money back into the economy. It's going to be this great circle. It's not going to be in somebody's bank account or some Cayman Islands thing for years to come, and millions and trillions sometimes of it either. So what about her van, which she calls Vanguard?
Great name.
I also get the feeling that's pretty new, although the van itself is not new, but her traveling in it, I feel like, has to be pretty new. And when she meets that old quote-unquote friend, it's probably an expositional dump opportunity more than anything else. She's going to explain her situation to the young girl who she tutored at some point. The girl is not mean-spirited, but says, so you're homeless?
She questions her with the innocence of a child.
And she cares about her, so it's not looking down on her. But then Fern's response is, just houseless. We get into these kinds of word wars all the time now, especially in social media. I suppose people would say that about somebody who lives on the street, that they're not homeless, they're houseless, and okay, whatever. The point being that they need help, although Fern doesn't need help and really doesn't want it.
That's the difference between being homeless and houseless. She has a home. Her van is her home. You wouldn't consider it adequate, but it is adequate. It supports her.
Well, for her. So I guess we got into this a little bit when I did the nutshell about how I couldn't live without getting showers and TV and that kind of stuff. And I'm not really a traveler either. I am a housebody, a homebody. But could you see yourself doing this?
Not in a million years.
What if you had an actual souped-up camper? Then more so. Still no, but more so.
It wouldn't even have to be souped up, but it would have to have hydro and some kind of shower facility. But we go on vacation, and we can't leave this house for more than a week. We get so homesick.
That's true. Even when we've been on some great vacations and awesome places, we still want to be here. For years, it was just Fox we were missing. Then it became Fox and Sam. Now it's Sam and Tilly. And if we never said this before, for the last few weeks, we've had a foster dog, Teddy.
We've got an extra. We got a spare.
And we haven't really been anywhere, obviously, like no one else has for the past year plus. But if we were to go anywhere for whatever reason next week or something, we'd miss them. Yeah, it's true.
But we would miss the house, too. We like being home. It's nice to go away, but even when we've been able to bring our dogs with us, like to cottage trips, it's always really nice to come home. That's just our nature.
I like my routine, everything in its place. There's a nice moment early on where the gas station woman, I think she's supposed to work in the gas station, isn't causing trouble for Fern. She comes over to ask her if she needs help. She offers shelter in the church nearby, and Fern refuses that, even though it's going to be very cold that night. And then at one point, you hear somebody banging on the van door saying, get out of here, you can't sleep here. It would be melodramatic in a movie like this, but also not one scene of conflict with somebody messing with her, or any of them.
The first time I watched it, I think I was a little bit of bated breath waiting for something terrible to happen, because narratively, we expect something terrible to happen. Narratively, we see a movie about a houseless person, and we're like, well, this must be a tragedy. And so I just kept waiting for the tragic thing to happen one way or another. But instead, wherever Fern goes, she finds good people. She's surrounded by overwhelming kindness and community. And even in a situation where it's the gas station manager, it can come across a little condescending when people keep offering her help and she has to keep saying no, but their heart is in the right place.
That's not condescending. Not the way she says
no,
it.
No, anyway. No, I guess not. You're right. It's not. And even the, quote, villains, if you can even call them that, people like her sister and like those people that she hangs out with, they're kind of rude, but in the end, her sister does love her and wants to help her. There's tension there, but there's really love, too. In Chloe Zhao's Oscar acceptance speech, she said, her travels with the films that she's made have proven that the world is full of good people. And I think that that is the helium that keeps Nomadland from ever succumbing under its own weight. And being a film that is much more uplifting than depressing, even though it is about some incredibly serious subject matter.
Yeah, I saw the speech again, too, like I said, and Chloe does focus on that when she wins, I think, for Best Director. None of their speeches were very long, the three of them. Zhao and McDormand spoke when they won Best Picture. McDormand, of course, for Best Actress, and then Zhao for Best Director. The total combined was, I don't know, 8 minutes maybe? And some of his other speeches went probably that long on their own because they didn't put time limits on this. But Zhao did mention something about how she sees the goodness in people and it always buoys her, and I'm glad she's had that experience. So you can make a movie about Nomadland and have it be awful, and somebody that they know, that they're all friends with, Swanky had cancer, so it wouldn't be her, but maybe Linda May is attacked and killed, or even badly hurt by people that just want to mess with her because they can. And I'm glad they didn't go down that road. But I do wish there had been maybe a little bit more conflict. I don't know what it would be, though. I'm not criticizing, just that simple question that you have to bring up. The one conflict I expected the first time we saw the movie, not the second, of course, is that Fern smokes. Not constantly. She's not smoking in every single scene. And I thought it was going to be that she has cancer. That would be the big revelation in this movie, because that is, of course, what kills Bo, although Bo may have gotten it from the mine. But regardless, Bo died of cancer. That would be poetic in a movie way if she got it too. And I wiped my brow and said, phew, the first time we saw this movie, that she didn't have that, because it seemed like it was setting up bump, set, spike type moment for it to be that revelation.
So another way that it really bucks expectations. I think we've just seen so many films about the put upon, the downtrodden, and Hollywood has this real formula for how we talk about people that we're supposed to have pity for. And this movie refuses to have pity for these people. When we meet Fern, we're really inclined to feel sorry for her. She's living in a van. She's cooking in this cramped space. She's got her elbows tucked in. The weather's miserable, snowy, it's damp. You feel the chill.
One of her best moments is when she actually explains to somebody, more counter space, and it's about 4 inches.
Oh my God, it's like the size of a bread box. But as the film goes on, we come to see how happy this life makes Fern and how she really needs the freedom that it affords her. Our assumptions that we make about her at the beginning are really in our heads. It's all about our perceptions and our preconceptions that lead us to feel pity for her. If we just take her at face value, as we should, then we wouldn't feel that way. That's on us. It's one of the ways that the film is turning the camera back on ourselves and forcing us to question where our preconceptions come from about what we consider to be a quality life and how we feel like we can judge people for their choices and the way that they live.
If you're houseless in this country, though, except maybe in southern BC.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Then that is not your choice, because you could not live through a Canadian winter except in some parts of this country. So that's a little different.
And there's got to be people who do it, but you have to be tough as nails. We have friends who winter camp.
For a few days.
Yeah, no, it's true. For a few days. And I'm sure it can be done. I'm sure there's people who do it. But that is a different kind of life than what we see in this movie.
And this movie does not make most of these states out to be all that beautiful. Yeah, the magic hour shots make everything look good, because magic hour always will, even if you did it in a garbage dump or something. But we're not seeing the best parts of Nevada. Well, yeah, there's some scenic shots, of course. It's not Easy Rider, though, taking advantage of every great scenery you can show. The best parts of those states, Xiao doesn't really dwell on them all that much. We're in Nevada, but it's the northwest corner, where I think in Northern California, we're on the coastline, so there's nothing wrong with those parts of the world, but they're not places that most people are going to seek out and go to. We tend to forget that America is one of those countries, maybe the best example of this, that has so many different types of climates at any point in the year. You can go to San Diego in the middle of February and be comfortable, if not warm. But yet go up to New York, Chicago, Boston, they're even colder than we are here because we have the Great Lakes protection. And of course, in the summer, wherever you are, certain days, it's deadly hot, especially if you're in the deep south.
And this is a film about the West. They never go to the East Coast. I think a character even says, never go east. It's too crowded. They never let you park anywhere.
That'd be a long way to go as well. What would be the point?
Sure, but also it's a film about these wide open spaces and the frontier. Her sister says, you nomads, you live like the pioneers. It's an American tradition. I think there's a lot of respect to be had for following the footsteps of these people who made their way in these wide open spaces and those big desert landscapes with the wide angle lens, and of course magic hour, magic hour, magic hour. I was watching this interview with Chloe Zhao, and she was talking about how the hours between 4 and 7 were the most stressful things you could possibly imagine, because it was chasing the light, chasing the light, chasing the light.
Magic hour is not an hour. It's a matter of minutes, really. It's more like 15 to 20 minutes.
But if you're trying to get a scene where you want the light to remain consistent, you better be prepared and you better get everything right in the first take, because if the light isn't the same tomorrow, you're just never going to have a scene that matches.
Well, the scene where she walks along and they say, you want food or whatever else, just going for a walk. She goes a long time in an unbroken shot at magic hour. They may have done that twice, possibly 3 times if they were really fast.
Yeah.
But that day, they were doing no more than 2 takes on that, I would think, or at the most 3 if they worked really quickly.
And I read that that was a highly coordinated shot, that everything was very specific where it was. The people at the campfire, there's like an exercise or yoga class going on in the background, and everything was really orchestrated. So they had to get it right.
These non-actors had to be told, repeat what you just did over and over again, like background extras would be asked to do. But if you look at the IMDb credits, I don't know that any of them actually were, because every time you look, with the exception of certain people, If somebody's named Bob, they played Bob. If somebody's named Jenny, they played Jenny, or the same basic name, Jennifer, maybe.
Yeah, and as far as the acting goes, most of their, quote, performance really shall just ask them to be themselves, talk about their own lives. So when Bob tells a story about losing his son, that's a real story about what really happened to him. When Linda May talks about working since she was 12, not being able to live in Social Security, those are her real words. I don't know if there was really a screenplay in that moment. It's just that Chloe Zhao knew the power of Frances McDormand to emote with somebody, to share that moment with somebody, to get them to open up on camera, and they're kind of playing a part, but they're really playing themselves. And that's why the performances are so authentic.
Got nowhere to put your camera, and she certainly knew. That's what directing is where to put the camera. She really knew what to do with these non-actors so much of the time. The movie's not really about family, of course, but at the same point, it is a subtext the whole way through because of Bo, because of her sister and brother-in-law, who's a Coen regular. Joel and Ethan used him quite a lot. Her sister does say when they're talking in the spare room, you left a big hole by leaving.
That got to me, man.
But Fern really can't stay with her. That's one of the examples of walking down the middle of the street rather than the sidewalk, which she could be walking on.
It's cinematic, right?
But it's cinematic, and that's why it's there. Kubrick would like it because of the parallel lines. And then the other family connection, of course, is the dead husband. She takes a tour of, I guess it's supposed to be his office, Bo's office, and their old house. And we see that great expanse of quote-unquote backyard, because it's not really their yard, but one great view. Maybe it's supposed to be an homage, I just thought of this right now, to The Searchers, because she walks off camera to the left, and the shot cuts to black, because she can't fit in this world anymore. That's what The Searchers' last shot is basically saying, is John Wayne may have saved the day, despite his insanity and violence and racism and everything he's guilty of in that movie, and wanted to kill his own niece, maybe his own daughter. But at the end, he can't come inside with the family and live that quiet life because he doesn't belong there either, and he has to wander off to live between the winds, wherever that line is. Well, it seems like Fern's got the same type of fate in this, but in this case, it's not such a sad ending. It's what she seems to want. I don't know if that's really what John Wayne's character wants in The Searchers, but Fern, clearly, after all this movie, an hour and 40 or so minutes, hour and 50 minutes, does want that.
I agree. I think it's clearly a direct homage to The Searchers. And I think it was you that said when we did our podcast about that movie that that shot is supposed to be a metaphor for suicide. John Wayne's character at that moment has nothing to live for. His whole purpose was wrapped up in recovering his niece and getting revenge for the attack. And then once that's settled, well, where does he belong? Nowhere. So he walks away and it's kind of like a metaphor for death. The difference being that after John Wayne walks away in The Searchers, the credits roll, and that's the last thing we see. Whereas in Nomadland, she walks away, there's this suicide framing, but then the movie's not over. She does have somewhere to go. She does have somewhere she belongs. And then the last thing we see is that van, Vanguard, driving off in the beautiful vista.
Oh, it doesn't cut to black then. I thought it cut to black there. Okay.
No, because I paid really close attention this time. It's such a beautiful shot when she goes in the backyard. Come on, no filmmaker makes that shot at the end of their film and is not referencing The Searchers. So that had to be intentional. And then it has to be intentional to then not end your movie there and say, but she does have somewhere to go. She does have somewhere she belongs. And that's the last thing that we do see is her on her own. She's so independent. It's such a big part of it too. She obviously loves being alone. When she goes on her little adventure, she never brings Linda May. She never brings Dave. She just goes by herself to the Redwoods. She swims naked in this stream.
Full frontal!
Have we ever seen Frances McDormand do full frontal nudity
before? I don't think we've
before?
Seen any kind of nudity from her. If we have, I can't
think
of an example.
No, she goes topless in Laurel Canyon, briefly. You do see. Yeah. It's appropriate if there's a moment to do it. It's conveying something.
It's not sexual
freedom.
At all.
No, it's not titillating at all. It's really a lovely shot. Mm. But in the way that you can feel like you're the one skinny dipping all by yourself, just communing with nature and getting so close. She truly enjoys her own company, obviously, and she needs that independence.
Incidentally, the last 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, good example of why we can't really leave the life we have is we've got our little foster teddy on my lap and Bev's lap, and he's going back to Bev's lap now. He started in her lap.
He just keeps crawling back and forth between our laps. He can't decide who he wants to pet him at one moment or another.
Being quiet, though. He's not making noise like he often does. Or peeing on the floor.
Very good boy. He does that too.
So McDormand, we've covered her a few times before in Fargo, where she won one of her many Oscars. And of course, Almost Famous, we covered her last year in that. She's probably the best thing, or certainly one of the best things in that as the main character's mother. She apparently tried sleeping in that van for a while, but gave up on that and realized, I could pretend better than to actually feel terrible every day. So she obviously can rough it to some degree, but she is a Hollywood actress, and I'm assuming that she and Joel, maybe they don't live like the Spielbergs do, but probably pretty well, wherever they
they're
actually
millionaires.
Live. Millionaires. So they're living fine, yeah. I mentioned earlier about how she seems stern, certainly at this award show, and maybe even the better speech overall, the better night overall. Well, this is a better one overall because she won Best Picture and her movie won Best Picture, but in Three Billboards, despite the inclusion writer statement and the I have some things to say, and I thought that was all awesome, but I could see somebody watching that and thinking, why is she going to be such an ass? But at this award show, she didn't really say all that much, and even when Zhao said, and here's Fern, of course, the character's name, the name's Fran, actually, and I don't know that she was angry with Zhao when she said that, but it almost seemed like, my name is actually this. She didn't really seem like she was all that happy. And Joel has been with her at some of these award shows in recent years because she's been nominated a bunch of times and
they
has won.
They cut to him.
He always seems like
stank
he,
face.
I wouldn't say he doesn't want to be there, but doesn't seem all that happy. At the Oscars, of course, they brought their adopted son. He's Puerto Rican or something like that. Clearly not their birth son. They adopted him. And I think she mentions him as well in the award speech for Three Billboards. But he wasn't there at this show because they had a limited amount of people. Anyway, just to bring that up, but it seems like she's...
She's strange. She's
I wouldn't
a strange
say
lady.
Ungrateful, but you've won four Oscars at that point when she won Best Actress, and he does hug her. I think he kisses her kind of thing, but he still seems like, all right, well, I'm not going to smile because I don't do that.
I'm so curious about what they're like when it's just the two of them. I wonder if part of the reason Frances McDormand stands out so much just in her entire career, why she's such a revered actress, is because she's one of the very few actresses in Hollywood who truly has no vanity. When you aren't beholden to the shackle of beauty, you're free to create something so startlingly real that it blows audiences away. It's just so rare for an actress to really be able to strip herself of anything remotely flattering. Look what she was wearing to the Oscars. Did she even brush her hair? She just puts on a sack dress, no makeup, and just goes and looks halfway reluctant, although she's happy to win. But as you said, is she annoyed right now? Her husband doesn't seem to want to be there either.
Maybe because of the way the world is, the pandemic and all that, I don't know. But that's why you seemed when there wasn't a pandemic. Yeah, it could be their grumps, it's true. Do you think she should have won? You didn't see United States versus Billie Holiday, where Andra Day was great in one of her first, I think it was her first big role, actually. Also does Full Frontal in that film and plays a real person. She won the Golden Globe for whatever that's worth. And I think she won other awards and probably should have won this. Also an opportunity for Hollywood to say, hey, a black actress, first time since Monsters Ball with Halle Berry, and now playing a real person who went through some terrible things, a very famous person. Do you think this was the... You didn't see...
I mean, I can't speak on things. Yeah, I never saw it.
But do you think that McDormand was truly worthy of this? I'm not against her winning, but I wouldn't have voted for her.
But you would have voted for...
Well, I did see United States of Billie Holiday, so I would have voted for Andra Day. Carey Mulligan might have been my second choice over McDormand.
Really? Of the performances that I saw, yeah, I would have picked McDormand. I think her performance was so beautiful. There's so much pathos. There's so much going on without talking. You know, she has very little dialogue.
That's true.
And so much of what we learn about Fern really just come from her facial expressions. That wide-angle lens right in her face.
But she isn't big in any of those moments either. She doesn't telegraph, I wouldn't
say. She doesn't have to be, but you still can read her. And also the work that she did to obviously create these relationships with these other actors who were brand new. I mean, like, that's a task in itself to say, you're an experienced actor, but can you work with somebody who has never done this before and help extract a beautiful performance from them? And you have so many inexperienced actors giving really lovely, authentic performances. I think she deserves a little bit of credit for that as well.
I didn't read that they did a ton of takes, and this was probably digital because most films are digital now. You could do a lot of takes, and they must have had to with these inexperienced actors, but they could just say, we're going to let this run, and Swanky and Bob, Linda May, all of you, just be yourselves. And if we don't have anything that works for 10 minutes, minute 11, we'll get something.
If you're asking people to tell their real stories, there's no chance that you're getting a better take the second time around. You're going to get a more authentic reaction on that first try.
And there's David Strathairn, of course, does play Dave. So even he has his real name in the movie. And of course, Fern and Fran are pretty close together, too. Real name to character name. We covered him in A League of Their Own and LA Confidential. Chris and I did Eight Men Out many years ago. Always been a good actor. Of course, he's great in Good Night and Good Luck. And now in a Best Picture winner earlier this year. So Zhao wrote, directed, produced, and edited. This is her third directorial effort. Songs My Brothers Taught Me. The Writer were the ones before that. And she is going to direct later this year, it's supposed to come out, Eternals, which is a Marvel film. And that is the one that Kumail Nanjiani got buffed for. Angelina Jolie is in that. So I'm very curious to see this type of director, who's still fairly new at doing this. She's done only 3 movies before it, doing that kind of film. I think it'll probably be interesting, at the very least interesting, if not really great. China was happy about her nomination because, of course, she is Chinese, first and foremost. She was born there. Then they found out she'd been critical of China in the past, and they quashed it. I don't know that the average Chinese person even knows she won the Oscar. Maybe they knew she was nominated, but they probably didn't hear she won the Oscar. So that's part of the state media over there.
It's funny how 2 of the most truly American films at least were on Oscar radar this year, and that's this film and Minari, that are truly about America and the American experience, were both made by immigrants. So it takes this outsider view to shine the light.
People that struggled more, people that were not handed everything the way that a lot of people in Hollywood get that. I've talked about that in one of the podcasts with either you or Chris in the last few months, or at least a year, where the way the unions work, hopefully, maybe this isn't quite so true anymore, you weren't in one unless you had an in. Well, that means somebody was already a gaffer, or they were the cinematographer, or they were an editing assistant, or they were maybe even the director himself, or well, usually him, but could be herself. And that person probably is doing well, so in some way or another, you have money probably too. So that's something that has been changing and hopefully keeps changing. Zhao did thank Jessica Bruder for her 2017 book. She lived in a camper van for months, like apparently McDormand. Well, McDormand didn't last months, but Bruder really did, and she got to know these people and then wrote a book about it only a couple of years ago. And I already said the producers, Peter Spears, who did also produce Call Me By Your Name, which I still haven't seen a second time. Going to have to do that soon enough. Molly Asher, who works with Zhao many times, well, 3 so far, I think all 3 movies. And Dan Janvey, who also produced Beasts of the Southern Wild, another movie about a world you didn't really know about. I think it's supposed to be Louisiana, also nominated for Best Picture. The movie is 2 through 9 to 1, taking advantage of those wide vistas and showing us so much of the countryside in the west of America. Saw it on Disney Plus. Let's hope it gets a theatrical run, and maybe we'll go see it if it does later this year, whenever we can go. We are vaxxed, by the way. We've been vaxxed for about a month, but only halfway. We only get the first shot. Canada is a little behind America in that realm. We talked about Joshua James Richards shooting it. Zhao edited. The only other edit so far for her was Songs My Brothers Taught Me, her own film. She didn't cut, according to the IMDb, Eternals. And the composer, Ludovico Einaudi, did music for The Intouchables from 2011, very lauded film online, which was remade with Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart a couple years ago, I think it was. Big hit in America, that one was, but a very lauded film from 2011. And also another great movie from last year, one of the best ones in addition to this, and Minari, was The Father. Mm-hmm. So he had a big year last year, this year, whatever. I think they're both technically this year, The Father and Nomadland, but he composed music for both of those. As for what happens next, well, I think Fern gets in a car accident and wins a giant settlement. And with that money, she buys a mansion and turns into a rich a-hole. Completely reversing course what's in this movie. That wouldn't happen. So here's the or on what happens next. She does this as long as she can before her body fails on her, because she's not young now and you can't do this forever.
Yeah, they don't really address that part.
I didn't ask you what you thought about the look. Well, we talked about the look, I guess, through the podcast here, but the cinematography, the editing, and the composing, the music.
I didn't like the score. It's too maudlin. As far as the cinematography and the sound, I was reading this interview with Zhao where she talked about how they took such great care to get the look and especially the sound right while they were on location, because she didn't want to have to do any elaborate color correction or to replace any of the natural sound with something artificial. She was determined not to let the film become artificial in any way, to let the sheen of cinema get between Fern and the audience, and you really do feel it. It does feel like you're really there, and you can really easily forget that you're watching a movie, and it has that really documentary feel. So I just think it's so beautiful. I think it adds so much to the film. And I just have to laud her for making this film that has so little plot and yet is somehow not boring. On paper, it should be excruciating. But I think the secret to it being so engaging instead of losing its momentum is that there's so little exposition. So we're always at work trying to figure out what's happening from context clues. All the exposition is in the little details, and the details are so rich. Whether it's about where she's working, who she's talking to, what she's wearing. It's like a puzzle and you're constantly trying to figure out what's going on while the movie wraps you up in its feel and its mood. And of course, because Frances McDormand is just a force of nature and she has this one-of-a-kind magnetism that makes it impossible to look away from her. But it feels like a magic trick when you get to the end of this film and you're like, I don't even know what happened, but I was wrapped. I was convinced this is a mistake. I'm going to find this movie so boring because we just watched it. But not one temptation to look at my phone. I was absolutely in it from the first frame.
And it was your favorite film of last year. But this Oscar stretch, this weird year we've had where it was all of 2020 was up for the Oscars this past year, plus some of 2021. But it was your favorite, certainly one of my favorite films too from that time frame. We didn't really dwell on the fact that it's the second woman to ever win the Best Director Oscar, and of course the first non-white woman, I should say, to win that award. Well, there's only one of the two so far, and one of the very few women ever nominated, period, although there were two in one year, because Emerald Fennell, who did win for a screenplay that night, the first award of the night, was up for the award too, so the first time two in one year, and I think it's something like six or seven total ever now. That'll probably change as the years go on. A, because of opportunity, and B, because there will be some element of, her film, whoever her is, was pretty good, and we want to be aware. The Academy will probably be more aware of that kind of thing. It won't be a token thing, but it'll be more a matter of, you don't have to make the perfect film to get nominated the way it might have been in the past. It'll be, your film is pretty good, like some of the other pretty good Best Picture nominees over the years. And of course, Lee Isaac Chung is not a white guy, so a very unusual Best Director field.
Saying that Affirmative Action is going to win Emerald Fennell an Oscar.
She already won an Oscar.
Well, for directing.
It's an element of this. That's one reason why that stuff works.
I was thinking about this because, curiously, Nomadland and The Hurt Locker, which is the only other film where a woman won an Oscar for Best Directing, and that was Catherine
Bigelow,
thank you. They share a lot in common. They're both these documentary-style, honest, raw portrayals of a stark reality at the time that was newsworthy.
Both made no money.
They were both very independent films. They didn't make very much money, not very much script or plot-heavy. Their movie's just as much about the setting as the people. They're both films about people who are really devoted to a lifestyle that would make most of us incredibly uncomfortable. Probably the most obvious explanation for these similarities is just that movies like this tend to be cheaper to make. Small crews, not that many bells and whistles. You can use non-famous actors, and women directors tend to be forced to work with much smaller budgets than their male counterparts, so they're just more likely to make films like these, and once in a while they blow people away and win Oscar for Best Picture and Best Director. A lot of independent films look the same because that's how you make a cheap film.
If I had a vote and it wasn't for Lee Isaac Chung for the movie that I so far prefer, but only saw that once, Minari, then it would have been for her, and it wouldn't have felt like a token nomination. She made a brilliant film. Actually, maybe I preferred The Father overall, but that wasn't nominated for Best Director. It was nominated for Best Picture. And of course, Anthony Hopkins won controversially at the end of the night because people thought it was going to be Chadwick Boseman, and it was not, and also he wasn't allowed to be on Zoom, and they ended that melodramatic way.
It also won Best Screenplay.
Mm-hmm. And The Father was a surprisingly excellent film. I thought it would be a good film, but man, the performances are wonderful. And so many touches. I don't want to give anything away. Not that it's a huge twist movie by any means, but there's some things in that. Probably if you're like us, you'll watch it and think, wait a minute, is that different? Oh, it is. Oh, that's why. I won't say anything more than that. Maybe that already gives it a little bit away. Okay, well, Nomadland, wonderful film. It's lovely, quiet, sometimes devastating. Doesn't preach to us or lecture about how society has forced people into becoming nomads. We get the point that somewhat that is true, somewhat's their choice. Will it stand out as one of the great Best Picture winners of all time? Maybe not, but I don't think it will fade into obscurity either, the way that some of the more recent ones have. No one talks about The Artist anymore.
Oh, thank God. No one talks really about Argo anymore.
Mm-hmm. And maybe they won't forever talk about Shape of Water and Green Book. They probably shouldn't. We don't like those very much. But Parasite and this, the last couple years, probably will stand out as two of the better choices in the recent era.
I have more faith in it. I feel like it's a classic. I think it's an American masterpiece.
I don't like saying things like that after I've seen it twice and it's the same year I saw it.
I do.
Takes a little time, I think, to really feel that. Okay, the next time you hear us, it will be June 7th. We've decided to make June a theme month. And we'll be talking about four sci-fi flicks, the first of which will be David Cronenberg's body mutation horror classic that also has the sci-fi theme of teleportation. And that movie is The Fly. So the coming attraction's opinion question for The Fly: if Seth Brundle's teleporter hadn't turned him into a hideous beast, and we could actually use his invention to travel around the world, where is the first place, and this is really relevant the last year plus, would you want to go?
All right, so for the answer to that, check out our next podcast about The Fly. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. And while you're there, maybe you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. If you'd like to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
See you down the road, Jay.
See you down the road, Jay. And cut.